This is Carolyn Crabtree. The date is October 28th, 2009. I'm doing an interview with Jim Thomas at the McDowell House and Apothecary. Mr. Thomas, tell me a little bit about yourself.
I just celebrated my 70th birthday yesterday, so I'm...
Well, happy birthday.
I'm still sort of ringing from that. Born in Philadelphia. My parents moved to Kentucky when I was 15, moved to Lowell. My father was a textile executive. I grew up the rest of the way in Louisville. Went to college at the University of Louisville. Became interested in historic preservation in 1962 and went to work for, at that time, it is now called Historic Locust Grove, but back in the early 60s, it was one of two properties owned by the Historic Homes Foundation. And I was there from 1962 to 1964. And 1964, I was invited to come and be the assistant to James Lowry Coger, who was returning from Colonial Williamsburg, where he had been a resident for over 30 years. And the first 18 were in the service of Colonial Williamsburg as the first curator. And Mr. Coger was asked to do the restoration of Shakertown at Pleasant Hill. And over a period of a year, we'd had conversations about when he might need an assistant and when I could come. And my employment was started in May of 1964. And I remained there for 41 years, the last 30 as president. And my principal job in the early days, and a good portion of my job for my whole employment, was working with the buildings, with the natural landscape. And I was very honored and lucky to work in such a beautiful and wonderful environment with buildings that had had little care since Shaker ownership. So during that time, Mr. Coger was elected to be a member of the board of the McDowell House, and his concern after a few years of service was that the board was top-heavy with older, primarily physicians, and that he thought it would be very helpful for the McDowell House, and indeed to establish a new direction to have younger members on the board. And so I came on sometime in the early to mid 70s and remained on the board until 1990, and then went off because I had a very, very busy schedule at Shaker Village. I came back on upon my retirement. It was probably in either late 2005 or maybe 2006, so I'm on my second stint.
What do you feel like your accomplishments have been as board member here?
Well, perhaps having served before for a period of time, I offer continuity from earlier board service, and hopefully because I was involved in historic preservation for a total of 43 years before I retired, including my service at Locust Grove, that I had a perspective which could be helpful to McDowell House. Certainly the preservation of the building, the stewardship of the collection, and hopefully be of some help to Carol and the board if things came up which related to the administration of the house since I had the overall authority for a very large project. I guess it was the largest project in the state of Kentucky in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s.
When they restored this again?
Well, I was thinking of Shaker Village.
Oh, at Shaker Village.
Yeah, that's how I think I could have helped her, is that the experience that I had is certainly applicable to a house museum, which this is. So therefore, I felt that maybe I could share some of my experiences and some of my opinions, if you will.
No, we want to talk about McDowell House, but I am curious. I have lost track of trying to put the time sequence together with Shaker Village. When did that work actually begin, where they rerouted the road and all of that sort of thing? Because
the road was actually rerouted in my memory, and I haven't had to use my institutional memory and the time. I've been retired for 4.5 years. But as I recall, I think it was moved in basically two phases. The first phase involved the center of the village down somewhat past the West family, and that was in 1966 and 67, which allowed us to open as you enter the village presently in 1968. The second part of that phase, or second phase, was done in the early 90s, and it involved taking the road out to the old West Lot entrance, and at that point a new bridge was built over the over the Shawnee Run Creek, which flows into the Kentucky River, and that allowed for the road to be, the complete road all the way out to Highway 68 to be restored. And most of the original road is only used for pedestrian traffic and light vehicular, authorized vehicular traffic.
Yeah, on concerning McDowell House, you mentioned that Jim Coger, did I say that correctly?
Yes.
Felt that the board should have some younger blood in it. Have they continued to keep younger people on the board so that that continues, that fresh idea?
Well, I think so. It is hard. There's a young man who was involved with the Perryville restoration, Stuart
Sanders,
and I was very impressed with him. And then he went to work for the Kentucky Historical Society, and I think that he felt that it was somewhat a conflict of interest, and I guess it really involved maybe some programs that the society operates for the historic preservation community, and so therefore he resigned. I thought he was really a splendid choice, and that kind of person I hope will come on the board again, although I think, you know, he had very unique talents. He was a very, very, very intelligent and attractive young man. But I think that kind of person, male, female, would be just absolutely terrific for the board. And there are one or two other younger members, but I think perhaps the same problem exists. And I'm a senior member myself, and only am basically here until maybe they can find somebody who has a background in historic preservation and some administrative experience. I must have come on the board when I was in my early 30s, and I was really busy at the time because I was very, very busy with the restoration of Shakertown, and I was being trained to follow Mr. Cober, who had been made president while I was made executive vice president of Shaker Village. And at the same time, we had, in the middle 70s, the bicentennial of Kentucky, and the celebration was centered in Harrodsburg around the Harrodsburg Historical Society, and I was asked to be president for 2 years before and after the before and during the bicentennial. And then I went on the board of the Kentucky Historical Society and was president of the Historical Society in the oh gosh, 150th anniversary, which would be the sesquicentennial, and that was in 1985 and 86. So I had a period of time there where I was extremely busy, and I was in my mid-30s to my mid-40s. And that's a really good age, but it's also an age where young people get maybe overcommitted. But we really do need the perspective of the younger generation, because unquestionably, historic house museums, history generally, and the attendance to museums, regardless of whether they're history museums or cultural museums, has fallen off very dramatically. It has everything to do with changing demographics, how people view cultural projects and that sort of thing. And young people will, I think, be invaluable in developing new approaches to visitation, support, and just general relevance in the community.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I know we have this Disney mentality, it seems now, for vacations and things like that. How has that affected places like the McDowell House? You've answered that for me a little bit. Do you have any idea of what to do to improve that whole mentality for young people, young couples?
Well, I think what one has to do in each individual property is to find out what your audience wants and what your audience expects, and then try to measure that with what you are doing and what you'd like to do, and craft individually a program for each site that will be appropriate and appealing and mission-based. So I don't know that there's one panacea, but like I know there isn't, but it takes a good deal of soul searching. When I was involved in preservation as a young person, and indeed for many, many years, if we were doing what our mission intended us to do, and we did it, if we were doing it well, chances were at that time that you were quite relevant. And we didn't, at that point in time, have the competition for all the things that are in society today and all the activities that counteract and compete with one another. And attendance was quite easy to motivate and to improve and increase. In today's world, there's so many things going on, so many organizations who want to work compatibly but don't know how to, that we all suffer from kind of a mentality of too many things, and we compete against one another, and we don't join forces and become stronger. We compete against others and become weaker. So
there are places like Shaker Village who have living history people there at all times.
Yes.
Do you foresee anything like that here ever happening, where people would be dressed in period costumes and give the tours in a different way than they do now, for especially school groups and things like that?
Well, we always felt that period costuming reinforced what we were trying to do, because it allowed the visitor to come back with a, to have and come back with a mental impression of the interpretation as it unfolded. And I think that period costuming is very important. And I also think the idea of interacting, so that you can make something that is 200 years old relevant to the times. And you know, there's the third person interpretation involving actors, mm-hmm. and that works well if you have skilled actors and you have done enough research to know the character well and to be able to have the character make some sense out of what you're saying. But I think the main thing is that you want to try to give energy to the interpretive effort, and you want to be accurate, and you want to be memorable, and you have to be, in today's world, efficient, because everything costs so much.
I was going to say, the cost of hiring actors
is very expensive, and what it comes down to normally is now that people that are professional interpreters are there who have acting experience. When you go to, let's say, Colonial Williamsburg, you see Thomas Jefferson. He's a superb actor, mm-hmm. an absolute superb actor. And he knows all about the period. He knows all about Jefferson's life personally. And he can engage in repartee that is interesting. It really, I think, grabs the visitor. It's a way of
I have to admit
engaging.
It does. I've been to Plymouth.
Sure. Plymouth Plantation does a great job.
Places like that.
Yep.
It does. It's an experience you never forget, even as an adult.
Right. Now, the next thing is, does it really drive attendance up? And sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. One of the things that we found over a long period of time is that special events where you are doing something that you only do once that year or once in a period of years, and if the special event is planned correctly and marketed correctly so that people know what you're going to do, because the best event that's not marketed and publicized will fall on its own, basically, because people just don't know about it. But what we found is that special events do attract people and do attract a new audience. What is interesting, though, when you compare the audiences of, let's say, the 70s and 80s and well into the 90s, and the audiences of the new millennium, is that you only get one chance in the new millennium. And you can expect that that first chance will give you the highest attendance. In past times, if you were going to do a certain event each year in September or in the spring, you could think that with some accuracy that in 3 to 5 years, your attendance would rise each year, and that you you could expect, if it was done correctly, to have a substantial increase at the end of a 3 or 5 year period. That doesn't seem to bear out today.
Why is that?
I think it's because people are so inundated with new information, new opportunities to visit and go. The average visitor now is, and many, many young people suffer from this, they would rather be engaged on the internet or in some web experience, and that virtual reality is really more important than reality.
And oh, how sad.
It has been reported time and again as a real factor in attendance to history sites.
Do you think that could be because so many of them put a virtual tour on the internet of their buildings so they feel like they don't have to go?
That may be part of the reason. I think that this whole emphasis of information gathering for all the good that is inherent in having infinite possibilities for getting information is also contributing to, in particular, young people who are only excited when they see something that is extravagant, that's over the top, that is you know, exciting because of special effects, and they don't give what would be considered to be a, if you will, a natural interpretation, a chance, because it's just not the kind of overblown thing that they're used to.
Well, in every area of the media, it seems like that's the way it is. You know, you have extreme events in every area.
Absolutely.
Movies, everything.
And even watching the news. You know, I've just gotten immune to that, with the exception of trying to watch for the early morning weather and what local news might be interesting besides the home invasions and all the things that are reported. But I must say that everything has to be blown out of proportion in order to be heard, listened to, remembered, and the dispassionate way of reporting the news as done by BBC, PBS, for most people is a negative. And it can be even a generational thing. You know, most of our generation were taught to write, to use the cursive style to be able to explain their thoughts on paper, and to be able to read. And you look at the modern day generation, and they're not only problems with math and science, which I know are severe, and certainly in your field, Dr. Todd was speaking about this the other day for university training, but there's just a dereliction there of discipline and understanding. And somehow, some way, America and American society has to come to grips with it.
Yeah, I believe I believe you're right. I think our young people have no heritage. They have no understanding of where their families came from. They're so scattered and separated. This has to affect their feelings toward buildings like this and museums and other things. I worked in the tourism office across the street for a few years, and I've noticed that senior citizens, the retired generations, tend to be the ones who do the traveling to places like this. But there are a lot of school children who come here as well. What should be done to bring them back when they get older, in your opinion? what can be done here?
Well, I think that we have to make the history more relevant. We have to make it more interesting. I got such a late start in life with children, personally. Susanna and I have two boys, and my first boy was born in 1990, first child. And my second child was born in 1994. So I know firsthand the strengths of our present-day educational system, and I know the weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And both boys have more than an average interest and desire to learn history. And that's because I've taken the time to take them to sites and really try to make the experience fun and interactive and personal. And it can be done in today's world, but it takes a lot of effort and time. In some way, the history has to be made more fun, and the children have to be a part of the history. Mm-hmm. And not only in terms of being interactive with the interpreter, but to understand, you know, that these historic events, one upon another, have created this country, and that, you know, this is not something that's a distant past, but something that is within the area of the memory of many people who are still alive. And when I was growing up, my mother told me about her grandfather, who was a surgeon in Lee's Army of Northern Virginia. And he was born in 1835, and he died in 1915. Well, my mother was born in 1908, and so she remembered her grandfather. And what she could tell me about visits to her grandfather, who lived both in Virginia and Maryland as a physician, were really fascinating. And I tried to make that relevant to my children, that I could know my mother and talk to my mother about things that happened before her childhood, and I could relay that firsthand to my children. And all of a sudden, I think, you know, a period of 150 years was coming together for them, that it wasn't something that was so far back and so misunderstood that they could not identify with it. So I think that we have to find ways to get into their psyche in ways that are fun and exciting and are not dependent on these kinds of internet experiences, if you will.
Well, I know for me, I was not that interested in history until I started doing genealogy on my family. But we don't have any kind of classes in high school or grade school that help these children see that, hey, these were real people living in the Civil War that were part of your family, for example.
Well, and as you were saying earlier, I mean, most children have a disconnect. I mean, after their parents' generation, they didn't live with their grandparents, or they didn't know about their great-grandparents or their great-great-grandparents. And I guess it's the sign of a mobile society where you are born here, and then you move to here, and then blah, 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 and ad infinitum.
You have a lot of families breaking up, and you have split families.
Absolutely.
And all of that that has to affect it, too.
Absolutely.
Well, my granddaughter came here when she was about 10 for the first time, I think. She absolutely fell in love with the place, and she still loves this place. And I see that in the eyes of some of the students that come through the building. But you have to tell the extravagant stories, like you say, the unusual ones, to get some of their attention.
You have to find a way to engage them. And you're competing with the internet, you're competing with television, you're competing with things that are just, in my opinion, over the top. You know, these terrible detective shows and shows with all sorts of violence and just kind of general mayhem. And it's hard to be that interesting because, you know, when children watch that, they're just sort of sitting back watching it. They don't have to do anything. It's all done for them. They don't have to use their mind. They don't have to use their imagination. You don't have to imagine anything. It's all right there.
Well, when I was teaching, I can remember telling my students, mathematics is not always fun, but you have to learn it. And that's the mentality, it seems to me, of a lot of students today. They have to have everything fun or everything,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
Jumping all the time to even care if they learn it or not. What are your dreams about what McDowell House should be in the future?
McDowell House has a very important part in the community because it is a reference to the early part of the 19th century, and it's a continuing reference, and it's part of the psyche of people who are fortunate to grow up in Danville and Ball County, and for young people and families who come from out of the state and out of state. And I think it's always important to make sure that the house is in excellent condition, and one of the board's most important functions, I think, is to make sure that they continue to be good stewards of this property and that the property remain in excellent condition. I think it's important to continue research about the house and the family that lived here and the members of the families that lived here, which yields up so much good information for continuing to improve the interpretive history. It's important to have a good acquisitions committee that will continue to search out for portraits and art that belong to the family, furniture and accessories that are at the very least of the period and appropriate for a Kentucky house of this age, but hopefully have a family connection. And things do come back over time, and I've been lucky enough over a period of close to 50 years now to watch properties such as McDowell House be the beneficiaries of some really interesting things. And again, they're family things that are really important. So it's kind of a multifaceted approach for those of us who have been involved in McDowell House and love the house and what it means to this community and beyond.
Do you keep in touch with people who have items that may eventually come to the McDowell House in any way, or do you
Carol
keep track of things like that?
I'm not on the acquisitions committee, and so therefore I'm not sure from a board perspective whether that's done. I do know that Carol has done a wonderful job over a long period of time in staying in touch with family members who are sympathetic to the McDowell House, and she has a wide range of good connections, so that that's really helpful. And I think it's important for Carol and any person who serves as the director and the head of staff for a project like ours to be immersed in the institutional history and to be the spokesperson for the institution, because, and it should be, it really should fall on the staff members, because board members, although their service is valuable and the greatest contribution the board member can make, I think, is to make sure that the mission of the institution is followed. But if you have a good executive director and good people working to that end, you can be pretty much assured that this is being carried out. But it's the most important thing, I think, for a board member is to make sure that it is carried out. But I think to have somebody who knows the institutional history from the very beginning and what this place looked like in the period of the Depression and what it looked like prior to restoration in the, I guess, the first time in the mid to late 30s, WPA. And then, of course, to, follow the different administrations of chairman. Lehman Gray was the first chair when I came here and did a very fine job and was here for many, many years and was a very prominent surgeon from Louisville. And then his successor, I think, was Russ Scheer, and Russ did a wonderful job. And then his successor was Jazz Martin. So I think I've been here doing administration of three separate chairs. And I think the chair should always be a physician.
You do.
Because of the ownership of the Kentucky Medical Association and the need to remember and to put first and foremost, why we're so involved with this house. It's mm-hmm. Because of Dr. McDowell.
Now, it works with an endowment.
Yes.
Do you feel like the endowment you have now to work with is sufficient? Does it need to be increased, or how? I don't know a thing about the money.
I know about what size the endowment is, and I do know that the endowment took a hit on the the recent financial downturn. But because of good management of the endowment, it was not was not hit as hard as many other endowments that provide for institutions, and the endowment has come back to a great degree with the market improvement. I've always believed that endowments are the safety net for any institution, and the institutions that I've been involved with, principally Shaker Village and to a lesser extent the Kentucky Historical Society, have both been well served with endowments, and the McDowell House is certainly in that category, same category. So I think it's the safety net, and I don't know that you can ever be satisfied with where you are.
You should be, probably.
Because of the most recent downturn, how quickly it came on, how deep it was for most everybody involved, anybody in a 401k or an IRA or 403b felt it, or a TIA, whatever. Everybody felt it. So I think the board needs to always think of improving and increasing the endowment. It's the hardest money in the world to raise, but it's probably the most important.
Do you have anything else you'd like to share with us today, with me, about the house, about your thoughts about the house?
Well, I think if the house is it's so well done, and the things here are so appropriate. It's amazing that a house of this quality could be restored and maintained and interpreted in a town the size of Danville. And I credit the citizens of Danville who've gotten behind it, and the board that's insisted on doing the right thing, and the staff that's carrying it out. I think it's Dow House has done some really extraordinary things, and yet it's a very small house museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's led the way. The preservation effort has been taken very seriously. The people who have been involved have been very professional. The board has wanted to do the right thing And I think the house should be complimented for all that's taken place. Again, in an environment that is very small. And I don't really know, excuse me, of a comparable house in the Commonwealth that has done as much with the assets of the institution.
Now, I've traveled a good deal around the state, and was in Georgetown just recently. Ward Hall.
Mm-hmm.
I could not get in. It was had a gate closed. You know, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
I'm not sure. Whitehall, is it open in the winter? And I know
Carolyn,
they close
very,
here.
That's a very good question. The state has had to change their operating procedures for all their state historic, as they call them, shrines. And I know that the hours are greatly reduced in the wintertime, and there's some properties that are closed. And I know last year, for instance, that at Fort Herod, mm-hmm. in Harrodsburg, Fort Herod was closed for a good
so
long time.
So was this park, Constitution,
Constitution
Square.
Square was closed for probably, 6 months or maybe not that long, 4 months?
Not quite.
A long time.
About 4 months, I think.
Marquita Sparrow, who has the oversight of the state parks, I think has done a masterful job in trying to keep the most important things intact. But it's been very difficult. They have had reduction after reduction. And it's very disheartening, I know, for staff, and it's very disheartening for people that want to see these properties open and want to know they can visit them.
Well, I was working across the street at Grayson's when this happened, and they kept their staff, but they did not have the buildings open. We had so many complaints from people coming in who wanted to see the buildings. And I just wonder if that is something that you see is going to continue for a while, or do you believe that's going to have an effect here? Because it seems to affect, when people come over there, they will come over here.
Certainly.
And vice versa.
The idea of the state parks, not even thinking about the historic sites, has always been to bring people to the specific site and then have private enterprise operate in that sphere to take care of the many needs that visitors bring. I'm really surprised. I didn't realize that people were kept on and yet the buildings were not open, because it would seem that it would be a fairly simple way of just inviting people in, and even if you're in low heat, you can wear an overcoat. The Center family dwelling at Shaker Village is one of the coldest places in the world for 4 months of the year. And yet, if the interpretation is hot, everybody is very excited about it. I do know that the interpretation for most historic sites is seasonal, and the seasons vary, of course, according to the geographic area. But in our geographic area, you can expect to have about 80% of your visitation from April through October, and then the 20% in those other months. And it's just no matter what you do in the wintertime, it is harder and harder to sustain, even break even. I know we did met elder hostels for many years at Shaker Village, and all of a sudden they started drying up, and the elder hostel concept, which was really wonderful for mm-hmm. Shaker Village and many other institutions, colleges were using elder hostel, not in the winter as we were using it, but in the summer when their campuses were empty and the dormitories were not used. And it's a wonderful way to engage faculty who might be remaining for the summer and to use the facilities that were unused. But
Is that what hurt the ones at Shepherd Village?
Absolutely. And it was a national trend. And we went from having, perhaps 5 or 6 a year to, I think, I'm not current at Shaker Village, but I don't think they're more than maybe 3, if that.
Well, they have added an event over there that seems to be very, very popular, that quartet, that music event.
Oh, sure.
They have in May.
Absolutely.
I forget the name of it.
Partnering with Center College.
Yes.
And George, yeah.
Have they ever done anything like that here with string quartets or something like that for entertainment?
Oh, gosh, that's probably a question with Carol, because her knowledge on a day-to-day basis is much better than mine. The problem that one has with this house and trying to do special programs, particularly performance programs, is that there's no space.
That's true. It is like a house.
You know, you have a hard time getting people to stand for longer than 10 or 15 minutes, and things are very crowded. The rooms are quite small. Mm-hmm. Outdoor things, I'm sure, would be better, but if you have bad weather, you don't really have another mm-hmm. facility to go to. And, you know, there have been attempts to have dinners here. The facility is really not set up. I know at Shaker Village, we had to hone our hospitality services to a fine edge over a long period of time, because if somebody comes a long distance, in particular, they come from Lexington or Louisville, whatever, they really want to have the very best, and they deserve that. And you have to have professional people in the hospitality services, mm-hmm. and you have to have the right amenities. And if you don't have that, then people get mad and take it out on you. They expect you to have it. It's hard to do those kinds of things.
Well, I really appreciate your coming and doing this interview.
Oh, I'm happy to. Thank you. Thank you.
And if you have anything else you'd like to say before I cut off the machine, you're welcome to it.
I'm talked out.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to see you. Good luck.